Mike O'Mara, Radio Entertainment. Cake and cookies. Rob and Katie. It's the Rob and Katie Show.
Hello, friends. I want to start off by saying one thing emphatically. This is not an official episode of Cake and Cookies. Katie is not here, but instead you get me, your old buddy Rob Spiewak, right here in the Rob Radio World Broadcast Headquarters, and I'm going to conduct an interview. So while this is not an official episode of the Cake and the Cookies, I still need to start by saying thank you to Mike and to Oscar and to Boom Boom Bloom and everyone at More Broadcasting for allowing me to share this with you. I have known this guy via email, and I think it even goes back to a point when we wrote letters for years now. His name is Mike Sachs. He currently works at Vanity Fair magazine in New York City, and he is a tremendously funny author. And he's come out with a book that I fell in love with. It's called Poking a Dead Frog: Conversations with Today's Top Comedy Writers, where he did long-form interviews with 45 of the most influential writers of comedy that are still around to be interviewed. If you are, like myself, a comedy nerd, you are in for a true treat. This gets inside comedy like no other book I have ever read, and I think you will find the book fascinating, and I hope you find the interview quite pleasurable. So check it out. It's Poking a Dead Frog with Mike Sachs right here on the unofficial Cake and Cookies Radio Network.
Paperback Writer.
We are joined now on our Skype machine by author Mike Sachs, who, I must be honest, even though I've been aware of his work and actually communicated with him via email for years now, we have never met. We have to, full disclosure, reveal the fact that we have never met. We've never even talked, have we, Mike?
We haven't. We should make it clear that even though you're using Skype, it's still audio. I still can't see that beautiful face of yours.
Well, you'd need an awfully big monitor to get this head in. You would have to show it probably in pieces.
Well, I have a 34-inch black and white, so I think it would work perfect.
Well, I want to say, first and foremost, I am a fan. And I believe you actually first emailed me because you used to listen to the Don and Mike show, right?
Yes, I was a huge fan, still am of the show, and still am of the work you guys are doing, the podcasts. I grew up in Northern Virginia and in Maryland, and literally, I would say, this is no exaggeration, I spent years driving around in my white Acura listening to the Don and Mike show, just driving. It was sort of a hypnotic thing for me, but it was very influential, and I loved it. It really meant a lot to me. There wasn't that much great comedy coming out of DC, as you know. There was Mark Russell, there was the Capitol Steps, and then there was this, which was amazing. So it made a big impact on me.
Where did you live in Virginia? What town?
Alexandria.
Ah, okay, very cool. Just outside the district, so that's nice.
Yeah.
You have worked for the Washington Post and the New Yorker and Time and Esquire and GQ and Radar and Believer. And really, Mike, why can't you hold a job?
Well, here's what I'm most proud of. I worked for 10 years from 15 to 25, off and on, at various Catmull Records around the D.C. area.
Very nice. Oh, I still remember the commercial with the hammer hitting the record player. It's $5.99, and it's all the time.
I think the commercial itself costs $5.99.
But you are currently working in editorial at Vanity Fair, is that right?
That's right, editorial Vanity Fair, and I freelance with books and articles.
Now, that's kind of funny to me, because I don't really think of Vanity Fair as a go-to for comedy. Great articles, amazing, amazing magazine, but does Vanity Fair allow you to be funny? Because you are a very funny writer.
Oh, thanks so much. Well, you know, Graydon Carter, who's the editor of Vanity Fair, used to be the editor. He was the co-creator of Spy magazine, so he has an amazing sense of humor. But
love,
you're right,
that magazine.
Unless it has to do with murdering rich Monte Carlo millionaires, no, the sense of humor is not too grand at the magazine. But they do allow me to freelance for other magazines, New Yorker, Esquire, GQ, and I've written numerous books under their, the fact that they let me work here and write books. I think it's just, I'm very, very lucky.
I think the first book of yours that I ever read was Your Wildest Dreams. And that is actually a collection of essays that were published in other media, right?
That's right. That was a collection of short humor pieces in the vein of Woody Allen's Without Feathers, that type of book.
Right.
And those were collected pieces from New Yorker, Esquire, McSweeney's, and that sort of thing. I just wanted to put everything into one spot and just sort of move on And that was the last book before this one.
I loved it. And I know the book we're going to be talking about is called Poking a Dead Frog. But when you go to Amazon to buy it, treat yourself and pick up a copy of Your Wildest Dreams. My three favorite pieces, because I know you care, were The Bachelor Party, What You Need to Know.
Okay,
game show catchphrases that never quite caught on. And I think the funniest piece in the book, one that I've read dozens of times, When Making Love to Me, What Every Woman Needs to Know.
I once read that at a live event at a college, and I could not have bombed worse.
Really?
Jesus, it was horrible. It was disastrous. In fact, it was so bad that it put me off live readings for a number of years. I just did the first one in years for the new book. It was an interview with Bill Hader in Brooklyn. But yeah, until then, it was just like, oh my God, what am I doing? I'm not a live performer. And if this is a reaction, I'm just not going to travel anywhere.
Do you think is it because there is a difference between the spoken word and written word? Because the stuff on paper is so fantastic.
Oh, thanks. No, that's a very good point, actually. I think a lot of people who are good in a live setting have a rough time making that transition to the written page, because it's a totally different set of chops to be funny on the page. And also, you know, by the same token, I think it's a very, very different style of comedy to be able to perform live versus writing. You know, it's very easy for me to write something, but to do what you do every day, to do what live performers do, is a whole different ballgame. So I do think there's quite a difference, especially when it comes with comedy.
It's so funny because you, I think you've captured so many great different styles of comedy. And let's go ahead and talk about it. Your fifth book is called Poking a Dead Frog, which is not a cookbook.
No, not yet.
Can you explain what the title means?
Yeah, there was a famous quote by E.B. White, who was a New Yorker writer. He also wrote children's books, including Charlotte's Web. And the full quote is this: humor can be dissected as a frog can, but the thing dies in the process, and the innards are discouraging to any but the pure scientific mind. Humor won't stand much poking. It has a certain fragility and evasiveness which one had best respect. So I always like that quote. You can't really analyze humor. It's a very murky, mysterious subject. Oftentimes people don't want to talk about it because it's almost magic to them. They don't know where they get the ideas or why they get the ideas. So Poking a Dead Frog is just my joke that I put out a book in 2009 that was interviews with comedy writers, and here I am yet again poking the dead frog.
No joke can stand up to the autopsy, because the autopsy kills any chance of it ever being funny.
That's right.
Not the case, I think, in this book. It's such a fascinating way to get inside the heads of some of the most influential comedy writers that are still around and are currently working. I was surprised how many of them that I knew their work but did not know them by name. How did you put together this list?
Well, that was the thing. You know, I used to look at the scroll, the writing scroll at the end of TV shows or, you know, on screenplays, and who are these people who come up with, you know, who have devoted their lives to comedy writing? And that always interested me. So when I watched Cheers, the actors, you know, I love the show and I love the actors, but what really interested me were the writers for the show. So in that case, I went after the person who created the show, Glenn Charles, along with his brother Les. And the thing about these writers are, you're right, people don't know a lot of these names, but if you look at what they've created, everyone will know who they are and what their life's work meant to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're usually behind the scenes, and they usually have amazing stories. And to go after these people and to ask them who they are, where they came from, and their history, it interests me just from a pop culture and historical standpoint.
I loved in the first book, and here I am selling every book except the one we're promoting. We will get to it, I promise. You did work a little bit for Mad Magazine, right?
I did. You know, when I was I was in college, came back to D.C., and I was writing for Cracked Magazine.
Okay.
And it's a different Cracked than it is now, and also Mad Magazine. Yeah, so those were my first professional writing gigs, was Mad and Cracked.
How cool was it to get a chance to interview in the first book Al Jaffe, who, you know, we all hid Al Jaffe's books in our lockers and our backpacks? Was he a really neat guy to talk to, considering the fact, you know, you worked at Mad and he was one of the grand poobahs over there?
Yeah, it was amazing. I had never talked to him before. I had just written a few articles for Mad. I didn't work in the office.
Oh, okay.
But I was a huge fan of Al Jaffe's. I think he's brilliant. He actually invented a lot of things over the years. If you look at his Mad articles, he would do these fake invention pieces, and a lot of those came to fruition later on. But just a really interesting story behind this guy. He's the one who created the fold-in, the Mad fold-in.
Oh, did he really?
He did. He created that about 40 years ago.
Wow.
He also created Snappy Answers to Stupid Questions.
Love it. I had the books.
Yeah. I loved it. And he's one of those people that I'm just so happy I got to connect with. He's a total mensch, an incredible guy with a very, very interesting background. He grew up Southern in Savannah, and then his mom took him back to Europe just before World War II. He went back to the States. His mom stayed behind and actually was killed. But he grew up with half of the original Gang of Idiots who started Mad Magazine. So he had stories about all these guys.
Wow.
Who wrote for the magazine. And just a really sweet guy. He's still alive, actually. And he's a huge influence on a lot of comedy writers, including Stephen Colbert, who's a huge fan.
You see a lot of Mad Magazine that used to be just isolated to Mad Magazine, but you see it everywhere now.
That's true. Well, Mad Magazine has changed, as you point out. But, you know, for a while, as you know, Mad Magazine and Cracked were it. You know,
right.
when you were a kid, there was no internet. It wasn't much cable to watch. So
right.
That was our link to the comedic world. It was for me anyway.
I agree.
And I think that's changing now. But I think for our generation, it was sort of the lodestar. Before one got into National Lampoon and Spy Magazine and everything else, this was a feeder drug into comedy. And a lot of it was really not just written for kids. A lot of it was very, very sharp.
Yes.
Satire. But it had a huge, huge influence on a whole generation of comedy writers.
I would say that for folks, and I think you are not quite as old as me, but I think in our rough age demographic, it was probably our first exposure to satire and parody. And it was so funny to see pictures drawn of people that I know from TV doing things they weren't doing on their TV show. And before you're really realizing what they're doing, you know, they're actually doing satire and parody, you get sucked in. And it was our first exposure to that, and very well done at that, I think.
Well, I know. I totally agree with that. I mean, this stuff was incredibly, well, first of all, it was beautiful to look at. The artists that did this work were at the top of their game, and they made this stuff visually incredible, very accurate portrayals. But you're right, they would do parody, but within that parody oftentimes was satire. Now, that was the first satire I came across. I had seen parody before, but it was sort of coded in a way that I didn't even know what it was. I just knew that I liked it. And looking back now, it was a very sharp take on advertising and the cultural, you know, what the culture was like at that time and everything else. So, yeah, that was definitely the first inkling that there was, for me, that there was something bigger out there.
Now, the book that we're talking about today, Poking a Dead Frog, Conversations with Today's Top Comedy Writers, it reads like a who's who of comedy, and not just modern, but also classic. We're talking, I mean, Mark Maron, Paul F. Tompkins, Bob Elliott, people from all scopes and all vistas. What inspired you to get into these people's head, and how hard was it to chase down all these interviews?
Well, you know what's funny? When I first did the first book, it was in 2007,
mm-hmm.
and it was a lot easier getting these people because at that time there were very few podcasts. Mark Maron didn't exist with his podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Comedic sites like Splitsider, it just didn't exist. So the competition is much fiercer now.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, it was difficult to get these people for this book, if only because each of these interviews are long form. They're Playboy style, Paris
right.
Review style interviews, and it takes a number of hours to get it done right. So I really needed to get a commitment from these guys to talk with me and just to keep talking with me, rather than just giving me a quick interview. So really, it was a combination. The people in the book are those whose work I like, regardless of the medium. You know, there's graphic novelists and there's TV mm-hmm. writers, writers for print, cartoonists, and also a combination of their willingness to talk about themselves and their history with me for 10 hours. It's a tough thing to do, to talk about yourself and about your craft, and to do it in a way that makes it interesting. So quite frankly, there were 70 people interviewed, 45 made the final cut. But I am happy with those who made it in there.
How did you conduct the interviews? Were they via phone? Were you able to do any of them face-to-face?
Well, no, actually, I prefer not to do face-to-face.
Really?
Most of them were by phone. For each of these interviews, I have a 40-page script that I go through. I do a lot of research. So when I'm on the phone, I like to do file search and to go through these documents and to look up various things, you know, because oftentimes they go off subject, so I
right.
try to stay with them. These interviews are a combination of phone and email.
If they see you flipping through a document while they're talking, they probably think they're not doing very well.
Right, and that's happened a few times. One of the first interviews I ever conducted was with Marshall Brickman, who co-wrote Manhattan and Sleeper, you know, just an amazing amount of films. And it was in person, and I was flipping through it. And you're right. It takes them away from the moment. So to do it by phone, I can sort of do what I need to do behind the scenes.
Right, right. And I want you to know right now, I'm not flipping through any pages. I think you're doing great.
Well, I am, so.
Oh, good.
I'm rereading my book.
that hurts. did any particular interview subjects make you nervous to speak to? Did you hold any of them in such esteem that you were sort of a little hesitant to approach them?
Well, you know, the older ones, Mel Brooks in particular, I was a little frightened because this is someone who I grew up with, and
right.
he could very well be an uncle. A huge, huge influence in my household. He was always mentioned. So it was like talking to a living legend. But the thing about Mel Brooks and all these other, especially the older generation, they're very, very down to earth and very willing to give you what you need. Like Mel Brooks didn't need to talk to me. He doesn't need to give another interview. But he took time out of his week to answer a million questions and just to be a real mensch about it. So, you know, there were a few people I was quite a little nervous to talk with, but they quickly put me at ease.
Can I pick your brain a little bit about Mel Brooks, because I'm a massive fan?
Yes.
I would think that, you know, he has been at it so long that it would be hard to come up with new questions to go into his psyche,
right.
stuff he hasn't covered before, and yet you found it. You actually got sort of cerebral and talking about life and death with Mel, and I found it fascinating. Did you think the interview would go there?
Well, actually, yeah, because I, you know, before I interview someone, I'm always very, very well prepared. So I knew stories that I wanted to talk to him about. And actually, I learned that as a child in New York City, he came across someone who had leaped to their death in the city off of a building. And he said, it was just in one interview, I think I found, and he said that this haunted him for the rest of his life. So I thought by bringing that up, I could then get into more serious topics. And actually, quite frankly, a lot of these comedy writers would rather talk about life and death issues than jokes, because all their obsessions, and this goes for Woody Allen and most comedians, is what are we here for? What's our purpose? And what happens after we die? And Mel, he's a very serious person, and he takes comedy seriously, but he also takes life seriously. He's a very philosophical person. But there's actually one question that I wanted to ask him, and we just ran out of time. He took drum lessons as a child from Buddy Rich.
No way!
Yeah. I'm sure you've heard the Buddy Rich tape. So him.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to know how he was teaching a child the drums. But
it surprises me that you would get Mel to get into that sort of arena of a little bit more philosophical stuff. But when I think back, I guess that's only because I really know Mel from The Tonight Show. And obviously, that's not what Carson is going to bring up. You know, he's out there doing a show. And I love that you got inside his head like that. And you mentioned that many comedians are, when you interview them, particularly long form, they're going to be more philosophical. Why do you suppose that so many of them would prefer to talk about that as opposed to just, you know, gags and yuck yuck?
Well, I think they got into comedy because of that. I think most suffer from depression, anxiety, OCD, and they take life seriously, and life seems to affect them very, very deeply. Now, I'm not sure if it affects comedy writers more deeply than it does any other one who works in any professions.
Sure.
I'm not, you know, electricians, I'm sure, think about this too, but comedy writers just tend to write and think about it. And I think a lot of comedy comes out of fear and anxiety and depression. So it's on their minds quite often. It's usually the source of their humor. For instance, we were just talking about Glenn Charles, who created Cheers.
Right.
he talked about his father in Nevada, who was an alcoholic, and he used to go off to bars. And Glenn and Les, as kids, would sit at home and wonder what went on in those bars. Well, that, of course, I thought that was a direct connection to Cheers.
Right.
That this world was what they viewed as being the adult world, and almost like a magical world. So, you know, they grew up in this difficult environment, and through humor, dealt with it. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why Cheers is such an amazing show. It wasn't about laughs. It was about laughs, but it was about more. It was about characters and lives and how this group came together to form a family.
Yeah, Cheers really does hold up. I watched a few episodes this week. It's on, sadly, it's been relegated to the Hallmark Channel. But it really does hold up, and it's because it's based, I think, so deeply on characters, and characters that even could get ridiculous, like Norm and Cliff. Deep down, they felt real, and you felt like you could know someone like that.
Right. I think that goes for all good comedy, in that you can watch something, it's not too pegged to a certain time. All good comedy that we like, even if it's, you know, 100 years old, is character-based, because we're wired to want that. And you're right about the Cheers. I mean, that shows you the level of writing for a show that could take place mostly in one setting that revolved around different characters and their lives. Because even though they were foolish, some of the characters, you did care about them. They were part of the family. And, yeah, very, very 3D, very deep characters. And you're right, that show, I think, is just amazing.
It holds up. It was appointment TV then, and it is still fun to watch now. So in Poking a Dead Frog, you kind of divided each, I would say, subject into one of three different topics. There were interviews, and then what you called pure hardcore advice and ultra-specific comedic knowledge.
Right. That was for the comedy geeks.
That's me.
Me too.
I loved it. This really is like a comedy nerd Bible.
Well, thanks. I mean, that's the thing. I wrote this book. I until the first review came out, I was terrified that it would get horrible reviews. I thought it might be too specific.
Right.
It was geared to too specific an audience. I wanted to go that way rather than, broader. I wanted to go for those fans who knew Mr. Show, who knew, every Mel Brooks movie. But thankfully, it seems like there's just a million comedy nerds out there now. It's just exploding. And nothing was too specific for them.
It makes it, I think it's an easier time to be a comedy nerd with the internet.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, both as a fan and as a creator. I mean, the frustration that I had having graduated college and moving back to D.C. is what are the outlets? Where do I go?
Yeah.
There weren't any outlets. There's nothing. And the fact now that anyone in their room in Maryland can be on a level, conceivably, as any New Yorker writer, you know, you can have millions of hits or millions of views of your videos, I think is astonishing. It just has not ever happened in history.
As the provider and also as the consumer, you know, I remember as a boy, I had books that were essentially graphic novels, except they were not drawings. They were prints from Marx Brothers movies. And it was like Marx Brothers movies as a comic book, because you couldn't buy videos. And, you know, there was no way to bring the Marx Brothers into your home. You had to actually read them in a book form. And now with YouTube, you're three clicks away from anything, their entire career.
That's the thing. I wonder if some of the mystery is gone. I mean, I remember driving an hour to get certain very hard to find comedies. And I don't want to sound like an old man, but you can pull them up instantly now. But that sense of mystery that I felt was in a sense of accomplishment in tracking this stuff down, I thought was sort of valuable for me. But what I found too is, just because something's easy to track down, that doesn't mean people are actually doing it.
True.
You know, you can track down anything now, but the fact, you know, there aren't that many people going after the real, real rare stuff. So I guess there are the comedy fans out there who are still outliers and who still like things that most other people don't understand.
It's so great, the availability and also the ability to distribute it. I mean, my entire job now is based on the fact that you don't need a $3 million broadcast tower. You need a $50 modem. Or in our case, I think we upgraded to 70. But
right, the Tandy modem.
Yeah, we did. We went to Radio Shack and we said, well, give me your best. But it really, we have a society now where you can mass communicate for a minimum of effort and expense. It's great. It's a great time, I guess, not only as a a comedy consumer, but also someone who tries to make the comedy.
But everything's also fractured now. I mean, like going back to the Don and Mike show, I would get the sense listening to that show and driving around that millions of other people were listening to, which they were.
True.
Now, with so many choices, it seems that it's so fractured, there's not a sense of community like there used to be. That's not a bad thing, necessarily. It's just some of the power, I think, has been leached.
It's different. And I think some of that also happens if you're watching a show on TiVo. There
exactly,
used to be a
right.
sense that if a television was an event, and I guess you still get it with sports and maybe the last episode every season of American Idol, that everyone is trying to watch it live. But right now, I'm a week behind on Letterman. I'll watch every episode,
right.
but I'm still a week behind. And I know that I'm not staying up and watching it at the same time as other people. I think you're right. A little bit of the magic is gone then.
And I think that it goes for anything. I mean, I remember requesting songs on Q107, DC101.
Sure.
And when they played those songs became more powerful than it would be if I played it off of my 45.
Right.
Because there was a sense that others are listening to it and there's a sense of community. So at the very least, you know, there's that aspect of it. But at the same time, if I were growing up now and I could connect to a comedic community,
mm-hmm.
I think my childhood would have been a lot easier.
It's the same reason that my wife yells at me that anytime Jaws is on television, I watch it, even though I have the DVD and the Blu-ray.
Right.
She says, you know, it's over there on the shelf. I said, yeah, but it's on TV right now.
That's right. And it sort of brings you back to watching in a theater with people screaming.
Exactly.
That sense of,
exactly.
Sharing an experience with them.
One of my favorite ultra-specific comedic knowledge, I loved Bill Hader's list of 200 comedy movies that everyone needs to see.
Now, this is funny. I interviewed him, and we met a few times and really talked about movies. I had a whole interview going, and I sent it to him for a sign-off, and he wrote back and said, you know, I sound a little too much of a know-it-all. Can I send you something else? And I said, well, what is it? He says, it's a list that I've been keeping for the past few years. I said, yeah, sure. So he sends me this list, and as you know, I mean, it is a detailed list.
It's
goes
great.
To movies that, isn't it amazing?
It's and really fantastic.
That, yeah, and movies that you wouldn't even think of as being comedies, but that he finds, which I think is a good lesson, actually, that he finds funny, like Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah.
Which he said is a comedy because Tom Cruise wanders around town all night trying to get laid. That's how he looks at it.
It's true, though. It's true.
It is true. The fact that he would even make up a list to begin with. This was never meant to be published. This is just his own little personal list that he used to jot down in a journal in alphabetical order, all the favorite comedies. So that tells you what type of comedic mind this guy has, that even before he became an actor, he was a huge, huge fan and a huge comedy nerd of all these movies, going back to the 20s even. I mean, there's some old movies.
He seems to me to be a very old soul. I love his work on Turner Classic Movies. He is when he was on Saturday Night Live, was one of the ones that would always do sort of throwback comedies, the 1950s mm-hmm. game show or Vincent
right.
Price. And I
right.
love those callbacks to 50 and 60 years ago. I think he's that list was one of my favorite things in the book.
Well, I think that only strengthens his comedy. I think a lot of the greats are those who are almost students of comedy and are very open. I think, you know, for Bill Hader to know movies from the 20s or a movie like Miracle of Morgan's Creek from 44,
right.
I think that can only strengthen his characters and his comedy. So the more one knows, it's always beneficial as both a performer and as a comedic writer.
If you take out total timely references, and there's not that many of them, what's funny in the 20s is still funny now.
Absolutely. I mean, you look at the Marx Brothers, like you were saying, even they were so vibrant and so charismatic that you can look at a still
yes.
of them and you can almost imagine, it was almost like a Don Martin drawing in Mad Magazine. You can visualize them, their movement. So that was the genius of them. And also the writing was astonishing. I mean, even going back 2,000 years with these Greek playwrights, Aristophanes, there are some obviously dated references to donkeys and gods and such.
Sure.
But the characters are human, and they have to be, because that's what we know, and that's all we'll ever know. And, you know, good comedy, no matter when it was done, will last.
Now, I want to ask you, because I do consider myself a comedy nerd, and one of the most delightful revelations from the book was I had never heard of Peg Lynch.
Yeah, she was a real find. That was a total accident. I hadn't heard of her either. She was, I had talked to someone who was an expert in radio comedy, and I said, are there any writers for comedy, radio comedy, who are still alive? And he said, no, most passed away, but here's a list. Go down the list, see if anyone's still there. So I went down the list, and Peg was the only one who was still alive. Now, I called her out of the blue. I actually called the town hall in a small town in Massachusetts where she lived. And I said, there's not a Peg Lynch who lives in this town, is there? And she says, oh, yeah, Margaret Lynch, she's still alive, and here's her number. Gave me her number. I called, and we proceeded to talk for an hour. It was almost as if she were waiting for 50 years for somebody to call her.
Now, you need to explain that this woman is 96 years old.
96 years old, a very interesting background. Her mother was a nurse at the Mayo Clinic. In fact, her mother knew the original Dr. Mayo. And because of that, Peg grew up in an area where celebrities would go through. So a lot of celebrities would go to the Mayo Clinic, because it was the best in the country, to get diagnosed. So she took it upon herself as a 14-year-old to go up to these celebrities and interview them for the local radio. Now, one of the first interviews she did as a 14-year-old was one of the last interviews, if not the last interview, with Lou Gehrig, the day he was diagnosed with ALS.
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah, but that shows you what type of a guy he was. I mean, here's someone who knew he was going to die, and he took the time to talk to a 14-year-old for a radio interview. And she interviewed Newt Rockne. She interviewed a ton of people going through. But she was very, very influential. Her comedy, she had a show called Ethel and Albert, which I hadn't heard about, but I only did research after I first talked with her. It's like what we were talking about. It's very character-based.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very shticky. It's not Borscht Belt. A lot of situations that were everyday-type situations, like a husband coming home during Halloween and trying to scare his wife by putting the jack-o'-lantern on his head and it getting stuck, so he had to go to the hospital to get it surgically removed.
I read, when I was reading a little bit about Ethel and Albert, what it reminded me of, and I think you mentioned in the book, it's widely considered the first sitcom.
Yes, that's right. How we view the sitcom today.
But it was reminiscent to me of the style, not certainly as outlandish, but it sort of is a similar template to Seinfeld. It's a show about nothing.
That's exactly right. And I mentioned that to her, and she was very nonplussed. She goes, yeah, I've heard that it did influence Jerry Seinfeld. He was a fan of what I did, but she called it Ziegfeld. She said, I've never seen Ziegfeld.
Different guy.
Yeah. But I've heard it's very funny. Mm-hmm. So she doesn't even know what I think her influence. She's very, very modest. I asked her, how many scripts have you written over the years? And some of these scripts were 10 to 15 minutes. And she said, well, actually, I have them all, and they're labeled, and I've written over 25,000 scripts.
And didn't she write daily? I mean, it was a five-day-a-week show, right? So she'd have to turn out a script every day.
Yeah, and that's the theme with a lot of these older comedy writers, is that young comedy writers have it so easy that they have to write one episode a season. These guys cranked out 30 to 40 scripts, you know, a season by themselves. Mm-hmm. They were not in a writer's room. She was alone with a typewriter coming up, not only writing this show, Ethel and Albert, but playing Ethel.
Wow.
And doing so in a very naturalistic way. She said her pet peeve with radio comedy was everything had to be announced. You know, here I am walking across the carpet. Here I am picking
right.
up. And everything was, you could see everything coming down the pike, especially the jokes. But she had a very laid-back style, which I have never seen done that early. So her performance, too, is just incredible.
Now, another radio comic that you talked to, and I think it might have been his first lengthy interview since his partner died, is Bob Elliott from Bob and Ray.
Yeah, that was total luck. Actually, it turns out he lives 2 miles from my in-laws up in Maine. And I know his granddaughter, I know Chris, his son, a little bit.
Sure.
And through them, I got this interview. And just the sweetest, nicest man. We sat on his balcony in Maine, eating pound cake, listening to old jazz, just talking about comedy. Just another very, very modest guy. I mean, there's a case of someone being really influential on many, many comedians, including David Letterman, who adores them. Bill Hader, as well, is a huge fan of Bob and Ray.
Their writing was, they did very well as on the page as well as on the air. I always found that they worked very well in both formats. There was a gentleness to their comedy, but underneath, they could be very biting as well.
Exactly. Well, that's, yes, exactly. And I remember in college buying a book of their scripts. This is even before I heard who they were.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, it translates really beautifully to the page. Very well-defined characters, very sharp premises, and yes, they were very kind, a very New England type of comedy, kind, but also cutting, too. They would go after things that bother them, including McCarthyism. When no one else was doing that, they were making jokes about McCarthy, literally the only one. So, yeah, there was a real underlying denseness to their comedy as well.
Bob Elliott said something in the book about why he feels his comedy is currently popular with younger people. Would you speak to that?
A lot of younger generation do like that style of comedy, I think, because unbeknownst to them, the people that these people grew up with, Letterman and Stephen Colbert, they were hugely influenced by Bob and Ray with that style of comedy. And I think that's just passed from generation to generation. So I think if anyone's a fan of Letterman, Colbert, Jon Stewart, go back and listen to Bob and Ray. I think you'll really, really enjoy it.
Particularly Letterman, I think his pacing is so often, it's a slower pace than anyone is on television anymore. And Dave will take whatever he's doing in his first desk piece and sometimes blow it off and tell a story about his dog or his son. And you realize that he's just spent 7 minutes talking at a very relaxed conversational pace.
He was influenced by Gene Shepard, too, who did that. And that's what I think... I kind of miss is that everything, I mean, again, I'm going to sound old here, but the pace has gotten so incredibly quick that to spend time on a story like a Bob and Ray Wood or Gene Shepard or Letterman now, it almost seems like a hold back from another generation. It almost seems like a sleepier version of comedy. But I love that stuff. I love long-form comedy. And I think that, yeah, Letterman was, you can see direct influences.
Yep.
Even listening to Bob and Ray, some of their comments and their slogans, you can see Letterman using.
When you talk about pacing, I want to ask you about this guy because I've only heard him on podcasts and I haven't found much about him. And I want to know if you got a sense of the guy. I think Paul F. Tompkins is one of the funniest guys out there right now.
I think he's brilliant. No, he's amazing. He does so many different things so well that it blows my mind.
He has a podcast, the Pod F Tomcast, and his opening is a long, very relaxed monologue. And it is the most entrancing listening I've ever heard because he takes the time and he's got that pacing. He is so genuinely funny. And once again, anyone who is a comedy mover and shaker seems to have found their way into your book.
That sort of comedy always interests me just because of such a confidence that you can spend, and I hear it on your podcast, I mean, you can spend 20 minutes talking about the Beatles' Love show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love that, the fact that you can go into the nuances and give specifics about, you know, what kicked off each song and what it meant to you.
Right.
I love that, and that is the great thing about podcasts and various things on the internet now is that you can do that. On network TV, it's impossible. I mean, the pace, every minute is attached to millions of dollars. But the fact that you can do that now, and if you can pull it off, it's very, very difficult. But I think it's a great thing, and Paul F. Tompkins does it every week.
It's so amazing that, you know, even TV themes now are 12 seconds long. Because they want that extra 30 seconds for another commercial.
Well, and the show itself is much shorter. You're right. I mean, there used to be television themes, as you know, that told an entire story.
Yeah, Sid and Marty Croft did the setup every week. We had to figure out how he ended up in a land that was made of hats.
That's right, Lidsville. Charles Nelson Reilly.
Exactly.
A huge fan of his.
Exactly. Love his work. I'm sorry you didn't get him for the book.
Actually, I have a whole collection of Charles Nelson Reilly photos taken off the TV when he was on Match Game. I would love to put that into a book somehow, but I fear that not many people, maybe beyond yourself, would purchase that.
Yeah,
book.
That might be a what do they call it? A vanity project? You print up two copies?
Yes, like a vanity project worked at in a mental institution.
Yeah, I'll give one to you. You give one to me. The one guy that I could say that I actually kind of know in your book, and he writes another great essay, is Patton Oswalt.
Well, he's a Northern Virginian.
Sterling Virginia native.
Yeah.
But also, for someone who is that funny, it's not fair that he could be that funny and that nice.
I know. He's incredibly nice. I emailed him. I didn't know him. I emailed him and said, listen, I worked at Kentmo Records. I've heard that you worked at Waxy Maxy's, which is true.
He probably thought you were about to pick a fight.
Well, I said, listen, we have some history, but if there's any way you could put aside that rivalry and we can talk, I'd really appreciate it. He got back to me within minutes. I mean, he's very, very reachable. And I think he's one of those people who know and still realize where they came from and where how they went from point A to point B. Not everyone remembers that. I think the people who do remember that are those who are more reachable, and he's definitely one of them.
An amazingly kind guy. When he agreed to do the Mike O'Mara podcast when he was in town a few months ago, the only thing he asked was, when we're done, can I get a ride to a comic book store? Because Wednesday is comic book day.
Yeah, amazing.
I mean, yeah, Patton, I think we can handle that for you.
Right. There's a request we can handle.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just a real down-to-earth guy. And I'm sure he grew up listening to the Don and Mike show, too. I mean,
he was a tremendous fan of Mike's. And it's always fun when those two get together. Great mutual admiration.
I'm sure. You can see it in his comedy. I mean, I can see it in a lot of it. I was talking with someone recently who was also from Northern Virginia, and they're in the comedy world. And actually, this is up at Montreal, but just for Last Fest. And we started talking about the Don and Mike show and how much it meant to us and how it was really the only thing out there at that time.
So cool.
it was hugely influential.
Quick question I got to know. I'm a big fan. Is Marc Maron as miserable as he appears?
Yes.
Okay. That's all I need to know. What a funny, funny man. And another great essay. And I've just got a laundry list of people here. Was it great to talk to Terry Jones from Monty Python?
I got to be honest. He was a bit off his game.
Okay.
When I talked to him, he was, I think, ill and very, very tired. That's why the interview is short. But mm-hmm. even though he was off his game, I think he was still so smart and still so sharp that he gave me great stuff. And some of the stuff, like how poetry and comedy are very similar
mm-hmm.
in that they're very concentrated, where every word matters. It's a conflation of words, I thought was great. So even though he was a little sick that day, I thought it turned out really well.
One of my favorite moments in the book is talking about how when he first presented the idea of Mr. Creosote from Meaning of Life, the man who literally eats until he explodes, he presented it to them right after lunch and nobody went for it.
Right. Well, this is the character who vomits until he explodes in Meaning of Life. And yeah, you're right. I think everything is timing, including pitching. So the fact he did this after a huge meal, the other pythons were not too impressed. But my favorite story about that was they shot that scene in a ballroom for 3 days, and the vomit was actually salad dressing.
Ugh.
So they shot this, and after the third day, they cleaned up, I guess, as best they could, and immediately following that was a wedding ceremony.
Oh, no.
In the same room.
I'm sure it was a Mr. Wolf cleanup in Pulp Fiction. I'm talking
Mr.
fast,
Wolf,
fast,
get your
fast.
Ass over here.
Yeah.
We need you.
Oh, God.
Right.
And, you know, just the scope of the comedians in the book, and again, it's called Poking a Dead Frog. I said you did 45 different spotlights in different forms of these comics. And you're talking about people that were inventing radio comedy, 92, and also people that work on The Onion. You've got such a vast scope here. I got to know, was there any commonalities that you saw with all your subjects?
Yes, there were a few, actually. And it really is a fact that you just have to put your ass down every day and write.
Uh-huh.
Then it's a job. And even Mel Brooks is like that there's nothing to be taken for granted. The mystery of comedy is that even if you've been doing it for 70 years, you still don't know if a joke is going to work. So there's a bit of anxiety in that. But I think it's also healthy in that Mel Brooks is just as hungry as he was. Peg
yeah.
Lynch is just as hungry as she was when they were young. And I think all these writers who've reached this level, you know, as you know, doing this, it's just doing it day after day, putting your head down and doing the work. And I think a lot of young writers might not know that. They might be a bit entitled, or they might feel that there's going to be a magic hole that they can then pass through, that they could go into like a Narnia where they can
mm-hmm.
achieve immediate success. But really, it's a difficult career. It remains difficult. You do rise up to different levels. But it's also a career like any other. It's like being an electrician. It's being a plumber. You just have to do it and just work very, very hard at it.
It was fascinating when the people, that was something that a lot of people said, is that you have to keep writing. And nowadays, it can be something as simple as getting a series of great tweets out on Twitter. That can be as effective as getting yourself noticed as a screenplay nowadays.
Well, it's even more effective because it's short and it's sweet. And you know, a lot of these writers, including Megan Amram, who later went on to write for Parks and Rec, she was discovered by her tweets.
That's amazing.
So it is amazing. It's astonishing. I mean, the fact that she didn't have to write scripts, that she could write a joke a day. Now, these were great jokes.
Sure.
But at the same time, that she had that opportunity to jump from sitting in a room doing this to running professionally in California is an amazing, amazing thing. And it goes back to what we were saying before. That never existed before. I mean, there were different versions of that, writing jokes for comedians on the stage and Borscht Belt and vaudeville and all that. But to work the streets like those guys did, that just doesn't exist anymore. So you can make that leap. You can climb through that portal and make that immediate leap. But even though you do get to where you want or where you think you want, you always want to get further, and going further always takes work.
One last softball question while I've got you. Any favorite moments that come to mind when you're doing these interviews? Because as a comedy nerd, I know there has to be some.
It was fun talking to Paul Feig about Freaks and Geeks. I'm a big fan of that show.
Great show.
Great show. And we really went into the specifics.
Can you talk about The Notebook?
Yeah, well, it's actually a character Bible. And what a character Bible is, creators of shows, if they want to have a sitcom produced or any show, they create what's called a character Bible, where they describe in detail the world of the show, the characters, what they'll look like, what they'll listen to, what goes on in the background. So I never knew this, but the amount of work that goes into any show is tremendous. So what he did was he produced this 60-page character Bible that went into the specifics of this universe. And to such a degree that he went down and listed 50 to 100 bands, late 70s, early 80s bands, and who would listen to them, the Freaks or the Geeks?
I loved it. I ate up every word of it. And it was just so amazing that he has to think like every character and assign the likes to every character. And it was just fascinating. And he went, and the thing that's in your book is so amazingly detailed, and it's just a fraction of what he actually prepared.
That's right. He did think of all characters equally. And that comes through in the show, because one side wasn't any more or less important than the next. He's a very decent person. And that decency comes through in the show, and I think what makes it so great. But just the fact that the Geeks will listen to Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and the Freaks will listen to Black Sabbath, I think is an amazing thing. That he would take the time to do this and to try to create this world, you know, that he would try to make it a visual in his mind. So the amount of work that went into that is incredible. Now, in my book, I just include an excerpt from it, but the original version contains more than 21,000 additional words. So it goes on and on. It's amazing.
And it shows in that show, because it's not an over-the-top period piece, but it definitely conveys the time. For example, one thing that troubles me, if they do a modern version of a 1940s movie and they go back to the 1940s, every car is perfect and shiny, because those are the restored cars that are still around. And I promise you, in 1940, there were cars that looked horrible, but you never see them in movies. But on Freaks and Geeks, you really feel, you can almost smell that high school.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's a good point. It's a very realistic world of a Midwest middle class school, where people showed up and they didn't look like professional models. I mean, these kids look like kids, and they also spoke like kids, which is a pet peeve of mine, where kids on shows spout jokes or dialogue written by 40-something comedy writers. Mm-hmm. In reality, they don't speak like that. And what they usually say isn't that funny. And Freaks and Geeks had the nerve to have these characters say purposely unfunny things, which is very, very rare in a comedy about teenagers.
It's great. And your book is great. It's called Poking a Dead Frog, Conversations with Today's Top Comedy Writers, Mike Sacks. I recently listened to an interview with Penn Jillette where he talked about making the movie The Aristocrats. And he wasn't absolutely aware of it as it was going on. But what he ended up with was sort of a historical record of great comedians all telling the same joke, and therefore he committed it to the annals of history. And I just wanted to thank you for taking the time and effort to preserve these hunks of our comedic history. To me, it's invaluable and very, very entertaining. Thank you, Mike.
I truly appreciate that. Thank you very, very much.
You are welcome, Mike Sacks, and thank you for taking the time to geek out with this fellow comedy nerd. I enjoyed it immensely. Again, the book, Poking a Dead Frog, Conversations with Today's Top Comedy Writers. The author is Mike Sacks, S-A-C-K-S, and of course you can find it on Amazon. Please access Amazon through MikeOMaraShow.com. Got it? Good. Thank you. If you are still within the sound of my voice, that means you're still listening. See, I'm like Sherlock Holmes that way. An official episode of Cake and Cookies later this week. And until then, this is Rob saying thank you very much for listening, and I will see you then.
Portions not affecting the outcome of today's game may have been edited prior to today's broadcast. Cake and Cookies, the Rob and Katie Show. This is Dude Walker speaking. Mike O'Mara, Radio Entertainment.